Welcome to the Stage Left Podcast with Ian Brody. The Lightning Seeds, a super in-depth, fascinating insight into the songwriting processes of an absolute gent and a master in his field is coming up, so we hope you enjoy. Please get in touch if you're based in the UK about our live events. We're embarking on Stage Left Nights, where we have a live gig in our lounge in London with a performer link to the podcast. You get a 5-course meal cooked by an award-winning chef, a vinyl playback of your favourite record. We all get drunk. There's a live performance and the laughs come free. We won with Jess Greenfield of Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds this month. And in the new year, we'll be doing events with the likes of the Magic Numbers, James Walsh from Star Sailor. Imagine hearing some of his tunes in such an intimate venue. She Drew the Gun, Clive Deamer of Radiohead and Portishead, and Jay Mailer of Liam Gallagher's band and Kasabian has agreed to be doing one too. Can't think of a better Christmas present, hey? So if you want to get involved and want to be one of only 8 people in our lounge for those events in London to experience that, drop us a DM on Twitter or Facebook. Our Twitter is at the Stage Left Pod. Facebook is facebook.com/StageLeftPodcast or email Stage Left Nights, all one word, StageLeftNights@gmail.com. And also, if you follow us on Instagram, you can DM us there and you'll see a lot of behind the scene photos of the creation of the podcast. In fact, you'll see where Ian Brody and I were photo bombed by Ringo Starr's daughter Lee after the interview and loads more fun stuff. Here we go then. This is a special one for me. It's Ian Brody of the Lightning Seeds. So the first thing I'll just bring up is the news that came out yesterday. The Zootons have reformed. Have you heard this news? I'm guessing you have.
Yeah.
That something on the horizon? Cause,
you know, yeah, I think so. I think they were thinking about it. So they're going to perform the first album, which
you produced.
That's the one I did, yeah.
Absolutely. Good stuff. And was that a bit of a surprise that they were getting back together to do that?
Not really, to be honest. So I think they talked about it a little while and, you know, it gradually kind of... everyone was around to do it, and I think Sean, the drummer, has been in America for a while, so now he's back. And I think it's everyone except Russ, the bass player.
Oh right, okay, that's interesting. Okay, and we actually had Russ and Abby on the past, who spoke very highly of your contribution as producer. From your side of the fence, what were your fondest memories of working with them on that first album?
Well, it was you kind of have to put it in a little bit of a context. So I suppose I was at a point where. Early, I kind of did a lot of things backwards in my career, I think. So I was really in a couple of groups when I was young in Liverpool. And then when I was about 18 or 19, I sort of accidentally really became a producer, producing Echo and the Bunnymen. And then that led into a few years of producing various bands and stuff. So usually people maybe would have had the Lightning Seeds and then become a producer, but it was kind of the other way around. And then I was doing the Lightning Seeds full on through, you know, most of the 90s. And when it came to around about 1999, 2000, I'd kind of come to the end of that, really. I think I'd just come to the end of that emotionally and everything. It just felt like, it just felt like a break was in order. So I stopped really playing live and stopped pretty much everything. There's a lot of things going on in my life. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of bored, really, and at a loss of what to do, didn't quite know what to do. And a friend of mine, Nathan McGough, who is an old school friend, really, and who managed the Happy Mondays and various things, and he was in my flat, and he was saying to me, you're always great, you know, producing young bands. You should maybe just do something like that, and it would be, I'm sure, you know, it would sort of refresh you in a way and stuff. And he said to me, you know, Alan Wills, who was a common friend of both of ours, you know, he said, Alan's got a couple of bands that really, you know, you should give him a ring. I'm going to ring him now. And I spoke to Alan. And so in a funny way, I went back to Liverpool to work with a couple of unsigned bands, really. And those unsigned bands ended up being the Coral and the Zootons, you know, who eventually became signed.
How did you pinpoint them? How did you find those two particular unsigned bands? Why them?
So initially it was the Coral were really, really good. And I thought, you know, they played in the room. They'd been rehearsing for 2 years in the room without doing any gigs. And they were all a little bit too much in a way. It felt like they could have, could have gone a bit wrong for that reason. They were very, very set in the ways, and some of the ways they were set in weren't the right ways, if you know what I mean. But it was it's very rare that you get a band where, you know, every member of it is so great, and they were all friends from school from when they were very young. So a lot of boxes were ticked for me of things that I liked. So that was why I thought, you know, I really like these kids at the time. You know, probably Bill was about 16, 17.
Really? And, wow, that young man.
You know, and we started, so we started working together. So it wasn't really like, usually with a producer, you get called in to produce an album. That hadn't been the case with Echo and the Bunnymen, and it also wasn't the case with the Cross or the Zootons. So they were really, it was very early in their careers. So I worked with them for quite a long time, really, before they signed record deals. With the Zootons, Dave was James's mate.
Right.
And they'd kind of got together with Russ and Sean, and they didn't really have a direction. Everyone felt like they were a bit, not, people used to say, oh, are they Coral Light, you know, like the beer.
Right.
And that was kind of the vibe around. But I thought Dave really had something special. And then Abby joined the band, and I loved Boyan's guitar and just the oddity of it. And we kind of set about really working on the things that were special to them before we made a record. So while I was producing the Coral, I'd kind of, you know, at lunchtime I'd talk to Dave about stuff, and he'd play me songs and stuff, and we really developed it. And then we did a couple of singles just on, you know, about a couple of 500 copies pressed up and that, and sort of tried to develop it into a bit more like an odd sound, the Zootons, which I think it is. It's an angular kind of odd sound, and we really kind of pursued that to the point where, you know, it culminated in recording the album. And so it was, you know, it was a little bit more than, it was definitely a lot more than a job for a producer. Do you know what I mean? I felt like it was really great. And obviously with the Coral, working with them up until the first album and then the next couple, so we did three albums. And it was very much, I think it reinvigorated me, because I would play them, you know, records they hadn't heard and stuff like that. And it was a bit like when you start playing people, have you heard this? You start getting excited about it again. And it kind of got me going again, where I think maybe I was, you know, just in a funny kind of worn out place. It sort of reinvigorated me. So it was, you know, the things that have probably been closest to my heart have been the Coral and the Bunnymen, really.
Yeah.
You know, they've been the two real, you know, vocational things, I think.
On the Bunnymen, I believe it's right that you produced their debut because you heard a song of theirs, or some material of theirs from Crocodiles, that you felt was great, but they were playing it all wrong in your words, and felt compelled to tell them. For young producers, firstly, how do you go about having that dialogue with a band? Not to upset them too much, or not to put their backs up, I guess. And technology aside, how does your production style differ now to it did on that first album?
I've always been a very reluctant producer. I don't really like many producers. It's not something I ever wanted to be. So the story with the Bunnymen, it might not quite fit the narrative that you want for this. But they were kind of my mates, really, and they formed a band. And originally they didn't have a drummer. So I think my first input was, they were like, what drum machine should we buy? And help them pick a drum machine. And then I hadn't seen them for ages, and they'd signed to Warner Brothers or whatever. And I was actually at a bus stop near Penny Lane, Smithdown Road in Liverpool. And they'd bought a van, and they were going past in the van. And it was raining. They stopped and gave me a lift. And they had, you know, music on in the van. And I was like, this is good. What's this? They were like, it's us. We've just been in Rockfield with a producer, record company, but we're not really very happy with it. And what do you think, you know? And I was just quite opinionated, as I always was, really. And I was kind of like, well, you know, this bit is the core, you know, this should be here. And I was, but I never thought anything of it. Got out, didn't think anything of it. And then I got a call from the record company saying, oh, you know, the band said you had some great ideas about the songs. Would you be up for producing a record? So initially I was like, not really, no, I don't really want to be a producer. I think it's crossing a line. I'm a songwriter and a musician. That sounds like, you know, a different thing. And then Bill Drummond, who was the manager, phoned up, and he said to me, well, how about if we don't put your name on it, and we can call you, you've got, because we all had alternative names like K kids do sometimes, you know what I mean? You had your comic book name.
What was yours?
Kingbird. So so I said, well, as long as you don't put my name on it, you could just put a Kingbird production, I'll help.
Got it.
So that was really my, you know, and then I started, obviously, I found it quite thrilling helping them record, and that led me into recording other bands. And really, for a 5 or 6 year period, I was just a producer, really, you know.
And does your style now differ? As I know you say you don't see yourself as a producer, but stuff that you produced, you know, were there any schoolboy errors you were making at the beginning, you think, as a producer? And what might they have been, and what did you learn from them that differs now?
I think I would say, yeah, it's probably all errors. I think you are, when you're, but amongst the errors, you know, you get things that maybe are unique that someone wouldn't try if they were a bit more experienced. And it's still like that now. Now I'm more experienced. I have an envy slightly of people who just don't know to a degree what they're doing, and they find things that you would never have thought of, and there's a serendipity in the way that they approach things. So I think definitely there was a barrel full of things that I didn't know, but somehow we kind of, you know, we very much, I mean, talk about, producer's a strange job, really, because no one quite knows what it is, or people have different ideas about what a producer's job is. And
what do you, because you've done it well and you've had a lot of success from it. You know, you're a very modest person, but that is the case. So what's your interpretation of that then?
I would say it's a producer's job to do whatever needs doing, and that every band is different, every situation is different. And so it's about, in a way, identifying the deficiencies or what needs doing, and then supplementing what you feel, you know, isn't already present. Plus, I think it's all about making the band feel comfortable and put them in a situation where they can be their best and really flourish and be not afraid of failing. I think anyone who's in a band, anyone who's, you know, doing anything on the stage, you have to be not afraid to fail. And you have to be in an environment, if you're going to do well, you have to be fearless, and you have to know that you can kind of try things that won't work, and you're all on a mission. You know, you kind of almost take the ego out of it, which is difficult with some people.
And how do you set that environment to a band in a room? Is that by telling them at the beginning, or is it, how do you create that permission to fail, if you like?
No, I don't think you tell them that at all. Okay. I really don't. But I just think it's something that, you know, it's a different set of circumstances with every different band. I mean, for me, certainly when I first started working with the Bunnymen, I find, you know, music's changed an awful lot and it's very different now. At that time, it was a lot more innocent, and it was a lot more, you know, now being in a band is almost like running a small business with your Facebook page and your whole thing and your likes and turnbull, you know, which to me is really depressing. You know, I'm more into the magical side of music and the magical, you know, just things that might happen, something special, and not sounding like everyone else. I think there's a great pressure on young people now. Young people hate that. You know, young bands or whatever, young musicians. And old musicians, actually, it's every musician to sound, to fit into the parameters of everyone else so that they can be played, you know. I also think that, so for me, what I used to do, very much so, I used to find that bands quite often had a way that they thought they sounded. Because you think, well, these people are talented, great people. And I think it is a bit of a love affair between a producer and a band, you know, and you almost become part of that band, and you have to kind of share the vision. And I think, I used to always feel like the only bands I wanted to produce was a band I wished I was in. If I wished I was in that band, and I felt that they were doing something that I couldn't do on my own, and I wished I was with them, that would be the sign that I should produce them, really. But so for me, a lot of the time when I would work with bands, I'd find that they had an idea of how they sounded, and it very rarely was how they sounded. So it's quite interesting when you stand in with the band and they're playing and you're in a rehearsal room and you hear it from their point of view and you're talking about it, and you think, well, these people are very talented, lovely people, they're not stupid, why do they think it's like this. And then you can, I used to find their vision really and go, oh, I get it. And I can make it be like they think it is.
Nice.
So initially, early on, although that did change, I think I felt it was my job to make them sound like they thought they sounded. Once I could understand what it was that they thought they sounded like, and once I thought it, that would be a great sound.
Given that, great answer, but given that you've self-produced most of the Lightning Seed stuff, how do you find the idea of handing your songs over to a producer?
Difficult.
Because it's your baby, you don't want to hand it.
No, I just think that I have a very, very kind of dysfunctional way of working and writing as the Lightning Seed. It's not... it's a very, very, you know, I wish it wasn't like that, to be fair. I wish it was a bit easier for me to hand things over. But when I started recording Lightning Seeds things, it was kind of at a time when I was a producer and I was working with a great engineer who was, you know, almost like we were part of the same team, like, you know, we didn't even have to say stuff to each other. And also a couple of, there was a musician who I'm called Simon Rogers, who from the second album I started working with Simon, who I'd originally met when he was in The Fall. And we had quite a close relationship, and when I was producing things, they would often come in and help. So it always felt like there was a kind of a team there. And although it was generated from me, I think they had a lot to do with it. You know, so sometimes I feel a bit disingenuous when people think, oh, it's just Ian in a room, and he's, you know, I think they were a very big part of it. They were almost, I mean, I didn't play live, and it was a very strange, at that time, it was a very strange situation because obviously it was pre-computers, so you kind of needed a band in generally to make records. And I'd heard De La Soul, 3 Feet High and Rising, and it was kind of early days of hip hop. And they were sampling things. And I loved that album. And I wondered whether perhaps you could use that method in your own songs and, you know, not just sample parts of it, but still bend them to your will. And it would, because I didn't have a band really. So it was a funny situation where, say, in Liverpool at the time, a lot of the bands, you know, Sony were coming up and they were signing big record deals. So people like Mick Head, Shaq, you know, on a major label, big record deal, The Lars signed to go, you know, big, and Rain, the Real People, all these people were signing, and they were playing gigs and getting signed, and I had no band and no budget and no anything, so I had to find a way.
Yeah.
And I felt like if I don't do this now, I'm going to end up a producer, and I think I'm a songwriter, not a producer. Because the producers that I liked really, you know, would be Phil Spector or producers who were a little bit more lateral, maybe Eno, maybe Rick Rubin, George Martin, but they're all very atypical of producers. You know, I think a lot of producers, it is quite a, you know, it's a boring job. You know, they go from one project to the next, they have a certain way of working, they fit the bands into that work, you know, and it's effective probably for the record companies, but for me, it's not something that would interest me, you know. So I think I was coming at it from a sort of slightly different, maybe. I think when I was in my first, is this all right just to rattle on?
Love it, yeah. Fascinating.
So when I was in my first band, Big in Japan, and I was a kid who, you know, I'd bought my Television album, Talking Heads albums, they'd just come out, Elvis Costello, the Ramones, I loved all this stuff. And it was very all about the music. And I went into Liverpool City Centre, and Matthew Street was a very run-down part of the city then. It was just empty, a few empty warehouses, cobblestones, nothing really there. And I was, you know, unemployed, just left school. And I kind of found myself in Matthew Street. There was a big sign up on a warehouse saying, the Liverpool School of Music, Art, Dream and Pun. And I thought, what is this? So I went in and I ended up meeting a few people, Bill Drummond, a few people who played a large part, and sort of out of that situation, and Eric's Club opened opposite it. And out of that, Roger Eagle was kind of involved in Eric's Club and in Liverpool School. And it was a pair of Irish brothers called the Old Halligan Brothers. They just set this warehouse up because they felt that the ley lines met at that point, and Matthew Street was a great place for creativity. And out of that kind of situation, I ended up in my first proper group, really, although it wasn't that proper, to be honest, called Big in Japan.
But that was the Holly Johnson was in that band as well, wasn't
it? Yeah,
right?
And it was. As well. Yes, and the main thing that I, you know, that really struck me was I was coming from a very musical thing, and I think all the people around Eric's and around, including the Bunny Men, who were, you know, we were all a sort of extended gang of friends. Mm. And what kind of united us all was we were all pretty misfits, slightly damaged misfits, I would say. And we were kind of united by a love of the Velvet Underground, Bowie, Bolan, a couple of other things, you know. And so actually coming across people who knew the Velvet Underground and loved it, it was like a very much a common ground, you know. And the people in Big in Japan were approaching it from a more artistic standpoint. Mm. And I think after about the third rehearsal, I remember thinking to myself, wow, you know, I've been looking at this all wrong. If you've got a great idea and you can't play it that well, it's still a great idea and it'll find its place in the world. And if you haven't got a great idea, no matter how well you play it or how proficient you are on the guitar, it's not a great idea.
Yeah.
So instantly I just thought, it's all about the ideas, and it's all about, and I think that is the main thing that's always been through my career, and why my method of working as the Lightning Seeds is so kind of dysfunctional and different, and also why I think as a producer it's the same thing. I like to work with a band, figure out what it is that would be great. I mean, with the Zootons was a real case in point. I think, without being insulting, there were times when they sounded like a pub rock band, and it was very ordinary, but there were times when they sounded like one of the most special bands I'd ever heard. Mm-hmm. You know, when you heard the beginnings of Zooton Fever, and they'd been there, and you'd, so it was really a case of, a lot of the work was done before the studio, and just finding the idea and figuring out what would be, you know, a very special idea for them. And I think to a degree it was the same with the Bunny Men. It was the first couple of things we did were a song called Rescue was the first song we did, and it very much set the template for the rest of the career in a way. You know, it just, the things we did there sculpted the idea of the way it allowed Mac to sing the way he could sing, and he was so brilliant. And you know, so I've always kind of felt like I've always tried to find the idea rather than focus entirely on the music. Mm. If that makes any sense.
Yeah. So, let's talk about your songwriting then. One of my favourite songs ever. It's Pure. I wonder if you could indulge me about your memories of writing that.
Your Pure was my first attempt at, you know, being the singer and kind of writing a song entirely myself without, you know, and hadn't been in a band for a long time, didn't have a band, and I kind of wrote it and recorded it mainly. I bought an S900 sampler, and I think it was an MC500 or something, programmer, MIDI programmer, and I kind of just sampled bits off records and did this and that, and pretty much made Pure. And then when I wrote the lyric, you know, it was a strange thing. Eventually, when I was recording my album, and we were just kind of mixing the things that I'd done in a studio, and we got, you know, free nighttime sessions in Kirby, which is a sort of place outside Liverpool, and there was a studio there that let me go in for, you know, at night. So we were kind of mixing it there, and I couldn't get it right, and I found it. I hated it, actually. And
hated thought, what, the song?
I hated the song. I felt like, really? I've done this wrong. There's too many words. Songs aren't meant to have these many words. I've blown it. You know, everyone else's lyric sheets are short. This has got hundreds of words. So I cut some of the words out of it, and I did it, and we were mixing it, and I kind of realised that... Well, we kind of were mixing it, and I I said to the engineer, you know, stop, I'm not going to finish this, it's no good, like, let's just not just take it down, I'm going to scrap it. And he said, you know, I think this is great, I don't want to do that. And I was like, just do what I'm saying. So he kind of put it down where it was anyway, which I didn't know. And I think what it was, looking back now, is that what I was saying about, I think I gave something of myself away on that song, and I wasn't used to it, and I felt like it was, you know, I can't explain.
What was it that you gave away?
I just think I'd said, you know, it was heartfelt, and there was a personal feeling about something, and all of a sudden I felt like I don't want everyone knowing about this, you know, hearing this. But then a couple of people heard it because it was on the tape, and everyone kept coming back and saying, this is the best one, you know. And then I kind of heard it with new ears, and I was like, yeah, maybe that's what you have to do as a songwriter. Maybe you do have to be prepared to be vulnerable in a song, and, you know, maybe that is true, you know.
So how did that affect your songwriting going forward? Is that something, like, what were you writing about going forward? Was it always trying to look internally and kind of expose yourself and your vulnerabilities, or was it just...
I think it was just trying to be not afraid of showing yourself in a song, in a way, which it sounds like, you know, it's a very strange thing for me to be saying, but, like, I don't think I've ever written a song as good as Pure, and it was the first one, and in many ways that's a little bit, you know, you wish you could have got another one that was that good. You know, I should have just stopped at that point, possibly, but...
There's a lot of great songs you've written, so you've been, you know, a bit harsh on yourself there. But there's one thing that I noticed in your songwriting that I think is particularly unique, is where you do this on Pure, you do it on Marvelous 2 and a few other songs, where you kind of tease the extended chorus throughout the song before delivering it towards the end, almost like you're holding something back, and often changing the lyrics all the way through. So often if you hear other songs do that, they repeat the chorus over and over, but you're changing it throughout. So you do it on Marvelous as well and a few others. Was that a deliberate technique to tease the chorus all the way through and leave us wanting more before the final one?
No, I'd have to say I don't know what I'm doing, and I still don't know what I'm doing, and I didn't know what I was doing then, and I would honestly say that. And I don't mind that, and I think, you know, that sort of brings you on to kind of modern music. So modern music's become much more, you know, people can go to a college and learn how to be an engineer, a producer, a songwriter, a singer. And in those days you couldn't really, you know, it was a lot more instinctive. And I think to a certain degree you used to have show business, and the Beatles came, and kind of after the Beatles you had the music business, and it was slightly different. And now it feels like we're in an era where show business has kind of swallowed up the music business to a degree again. And, you know, I'm not saying that's a bad thing or a good thing. And so people, you know, if you're listening to this podcast, you know, there's finding methods of doing it. And perhaps people were like that, but I just wasn't aware of that. But I think it was a little bit more innocent, and it was a little bit more... You know, like the question that you just asked me hits directly on that. I'm not kidding, I'm not being modest, you know, I just don't think I knew what I was doing. I still don't really know what I was doing. Kind of don't want to know what I'm doing. I just want to do it.
You've always attracted great drummers to the band. So you had Chris Sharrock, for listeners who aren't aware, he played on There She Goes with the Lars, he was in Oasis, he's played with Robbie Williams, loads of people, he's currently Noel's drummer, and Zach Starkey as well. I saw you play Be My Baby at TFI Friday years ago, I was there for that, and he was playing drums, who obviously he was taught the drums by Keith Moon, actually, and son of Ringo, and now plays in The Who with lots of people. What are their unique qualities as drummers, and how do their styles differ from your perspective being in the same band as them?
Drummers, out of everyone in the band, is probably the most important guy in the band in some ways. Certainly in the actual performance, maybe not in the creation of the songs or whatever, but in the performance, I think, you know, it's really kind of if you haven't got a good drummer, you're never going to be that great live or anything. And I think every drummer is different and is really different. And even when they're trying to play the same thing, it's not the same. And much more so than in a way a guitar player or a singer. It's a really strange thing because it's such a physical thing and there's so many parts of your body involved in it, you know, 2 feet, both hands. So the kind of relationship in timing and in power between 2 hands and 2 feet means there's so many variabilities that they're all going to be very, very different.
Yeah.
And to a degree, it's interesting. So in the 80s, recording became all about taking away that variability, getting a Linn drum, sampling drums, compressing them, making them, moving them when Pro Tools came out so that they're exactly in time and exactly on the beat. And then as soon as people had achieved that, they started sampling old records, which were completely the opposite of that, to get a great feel.
Yeah.
Which is one of the great kind of idiosyncrasies of music. But having said that, I do actually, with the Lightning Seeds, with some bands like with the Coral, it was all about letting them play freely. And the Zootons to a degree, actually, because I thought they had a great chemistry between the band and that at a certain moment you could get something special that transcended being in or out of time. It just became a feel. People talk about feel a lot, and and it's not feel, but I think that at that point you can get something that really has a unique feel. But I think you have to be doing a lot of it at the same time. Now people spend hours calculating numbers, creating a feel. But my feeling is, this might be too technical,
we love the technical stuff.
But my feeling is, if I'm going to record things separately, and I'm going to correct drums and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think they should be corrected to the absolute maximum they can be corrected. And I don't like this wishy-washiness about keeping a bit of feel or a bit of this, that and the other. Because if you've got feel, it's about a reaction between musicians. If you've taken a different route, you can get a fantastic feel over a drum machine, but a drum machine is exactly in time. But you can still have a great feel. You know, you can Donna Summer, well actually that's out of time, but a lot of records, Michael Jackson, whoever, you know, the things that are exactly in time. And I think, you know, obviously you can make it swing, and there's things you can do to change the vibe of a feel, and there's a lot of subtleties in that. But essentially I think the feel is generated by what goes over something. I don't know why I'm talking about this.
No, I think you make a lot of sense there, because often you get bands who will try and do something in the studio and try and, like a live recording, and if you correct it, you're right. You either correct it perfectly or you don't kind of move things too much because you're going to lose that feel. That makes so much sense to me. Yeah, it's so much sense.
I hear a lot of records where that's corrected a little bit,
yeah,
and I hate that.
That makes a lot of sense. You once said there are no rules except don't be boring in the studio.
Did I?
Yeah, you did. Yeah. what's the least boring creative process you've seen in the studio?
One of the things that is so fantastic about being a producer is that you get to be around different bands. And you realise how absolutely different everyone's creative process is and how they're not aware of it. It's just, that's how you do it. And sometimes you work with a band, you think, how are they going to get from here to where we need to be?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you see them rehearsing a song and all that, and they have the strangest way, but they'll get there. And so, you know, that it is never boring because I think every time I produce a band, I learn so much from them. And hopefully learn a bit from me. But I definitely learn a lot from them, yeah.
That's interesting. You also once said that you hate finishing writing songs. Why is that? And has that stance been a good or bad thing?
I don't know if it's been a good or a bad thing. Because you in the end, you have to finish a song. Because otherwise... you will never go out in the world and no one, you know, you'll be. And that is, that sounds like trite, but there's a lot, so many people I know who can't finish a recording, can't finish a song.
Because they're perfectionists and they want to tweak it each time they listen back to it.
I think everyone, you know, people always tell you, oh, this guy's got amazing songs, he just, but they never come out. You know, you have to turn an amazing song into an amazing record. That's the hard bit, you know, because, so the reason I said that is because I feel like when you've written a song and it's not quite finished, it's really an open book, and it could be, in your head, there's so many things that you hope it will be, but it's only ever going to be something when it is one thing. So as soon as it succeeds and it becomes that thing, it fails on all the other things. So in a way, it's kind of a bittersweet feeling, because you've got it, it's good, but it's not what you hoped it might be. Or it maybe it's one of the things you hoped it might be. So it's always a mixed feeling, but I think that's quite a healthy thing, because you then have to write another one. And, you know, to a degree, you know, I suppose that's true of anything, because, you know, anything that's a possibility is kind of more exciting when it's a possibility. You know, I always used to get very excited seeing a band who you knew could be fantastic. They weren't fantastic yet. And you kind of might work with them, and then 3 years later, they're playing to 3,000 people. And it's never as exciting as when you saw them in the club, and it could be all these things.
Because you're attracted to the journey, I think, rather than the
end. I think you're attracted to the possibilities.
You know? Let's get technical on one thing. I was listening to a track of yours on your last album, Said and Done, and it's an amazing vocal, particularly because it's a very intimate sound that you get. So I wondered what kind of the, you know, if you got if you're a producer and you're supporting a singer to get a very intimate sound, what mics did you use? Can you remember the setup, what you did for that particular vocal take?
Yeah, I think that's you know, it's interesting that you say that. So, I mean, vocally, for years, you know, you had the guitarists that have loads of effects, the drums that have room mics on it, compression, you know, all the instruments, synthesizers, and then when you come to do the vocal, it's just like, here's a microphone, sing, and we'll put a bit of reverb on it, you know. And for years it was, you know, kind of like that. And I think, so you would get a lot of situations where what people would do would, they'd be, you know, sometimes you'd read about people having two microphones set up and this, but then you get phase issues and, you know, all these things. And it's really when it became easier. Well, I suppose you get the Beatles there, and they're putting you through a Leslie cabinet. And that's the start of something, really. And then as technology moved on and you have Pro Tools, all of a sudden at the flick of a button, you can put a vocal through an amp, you can distort it, you can do what you want to it, whereas it would have meant plugging eight wires in, feeding it out through a thing. So it rarely got done. So the thing that has really become miles better is vocal sounds. I think that's an area where the whole digitization of recording, I think, has been, you know, has made the possibilities for vocals, other than just tuning them.
Well, you know, one thing,
and you know, it is a bit over the top, obviously, when people just have that effect on it where it's like the tuner on full. But there is a lot of other stuff that you can do in between. I mean, for me, what the vocal that you're talking about, you know, a lot of the time, you know, you see the Beatles and they've got like an old 47 valve mic through a fabulous Pultec, and it's then you listen to it and you think, God, you know, it's not that there's no low end and it's quite distorted and he's, you know, and I think that's what make, you know, it, and I, where that comes from is they might be recording it like that, and a lot of people go, wow, I want to sound like John Lennon. But actually, those recordings are bounced across from tape machine to tape machine. So they might be starting off with a very kind of full bandwidth, but probably by the time they're on the record, they're not, you know. So that leads you to thinking, you know, so there's various, sometimes it is great to sing into a mic that isn't posh. For me, on that record, I sang into a PL20, because a PL20 will never overload, and you can be absolutely.
Sounds like right, it's right on close your lips. Up, yeah, it does, yeah.
You know, you can have it completely, you know, a quarter of an inch from where you're singing, and it'll, you know, it won't do anything bad, really, you know. So, you know, a lot of people would use that on a bass or on a bass drum and that, because it will take a lot of air and it'll handle anything you want to give it. But I quite like singing into it. And I first noticed that when I used to go and do tours, you'd have a record out and you'd go, you'd always be on the indie show in America, so late at night, and you'd be at some radio station in Texas, and the guy who was into music on the station, you'd be his guest, and you'd go up, and you'd, you know, it'd be like 11 at night, and it'd be quite cool in the studio, chat, play things and all that. And they all used to have that sound, you know, the big radio voice. And I used to notice it was always a PL20, and they'd always be really close up to it, and it would, you know, I used to be answering their questions and sound like, you know, really tinny. And they'd say, "So, Ian," you know, and it's like, "Oh, well, who's this guy?" You know. And I thought, you know, that was, I initially thought, I'm going to try that with vocals.
Have you ever been in a position where you've been dictated to by record companies as a producer, saying they want a particular thing from a record, and you've had to kind of be the mediator between the band and the record company at all? And if so, how do you deal with that? Like, that's a difficult situation.
I think there you touch on something that is probably one of the reasons why I don't produce records anymore. So I'm not a producer anymore. And I was always quite discerning with the people I wanted to work with. But generally, when you worked with bands, you would work with the band and the creative idea. You'd make a record to make the band happy, and of course the record company would then want something that they could sell and they could get on the radio, and you're all aware of that because you want that too. And when alterations needed making, you know, you'd get a call from the band and they go, "I think this could be, you know, maybe the management think this could be, make it, you know." And then there was a point in the late 90s where you start getting calls from managers, not from the artists, and then from record companies and not from the artists, and then from pluggers who are taking it to radio. And I think that's completely the wrong dynamic, you know, because it's on so many levels. It's just, you need to be working with a strong artist, and you need that artist to be able to go out in the world and go, "This is me. I believe in this. If you don't like it, I'm going to convince you, and I'm willing to do whatever it takes to make you love this record." And if it's like their artists aren't really sure, but the management liked it and the record company thought the plugger could maybe get it on one radio station, you know.
Dilutes it, right?
Who wants to spend their life worrying about that shit, you know?
Nah, you're right. That's good. So when you were big in Japan in the early 80s, you wrote a song that you felt would be a great theme tune for Match of the Day, and you put it out on a Liverpool music compilation called Match of the Day. That was the name of the song, I believe. Later on, obviously, you did Life of Riley, and that ended up being a song that's been used for the last 25 years on Match of the Day, which led to Three Lions, I believe. And often songwriters describe their songs as their own babies, and they don't necessarily like the baby going out to other producers or other people to kind of do different things with their song. You kind of handed that song over to a nation, and you had situations where Alistair Campbell and Gordon Brown fought over whether they came up with the idea of Labour's Coming Home, you know, Germany as a team covered Three Lions, and it's a song that is going to be played for decades and decades and decades from now. If I was to ask you for one word as to how you feel about Three Lions today, what would that word be?
Proud, but mixed feelings. You know, it's, I think anything you do that's that, it's become a very powerful thing. It's you know, it's become, it's really nothing to do with me anymore, as you just said. It's nothing to do with Frank and Dave. You know, it's become something of itself. It's like if you said, "Well, who," I'm not comparing it to this, but "who wrote the national anthem?" He's like, "I don't know." You know, "Who wrote Jerusalem?" You might know, you might not. It's, but they've become so powerful in themselves that it doesn't, it's not really about whoever wrote it. It feels a bit like that. It feels like it just is this thing that I'm not really important to anymore. It's become an entity in itself, you know.
Do you feel it's like out of your control almost, and you want to kind of want it to come back to you a little bit?
Because no, there's just different interpretations of it, you know.
Say again?
I don't want it back.
You don't want it back.
It's coming home. It's coming home. It's
said pride and mixed feelings. What are the mixed feelings?
I think mixed feelings because as a band, I mean, Lightning Seeds, I suppose, as you say, is a one-man band, and I'm kind of a studio fella at that time. And on the third album, so I still hadn't done a gig really, ever, and then the third album was Jollification. And they kind of prized me out of the studio.
Who's they?
Well, it was actually one of my closest friends now, a guy called Rob, who signed me to Sony, gotcha. Who I kind of knew before. And he, you know, I'd been on an indie label before that, and then Rough Trade had gone bankrupt and all that. And I was sort of just recording Jollification myself without really thinking about whether to release it or anything really. I didn't really have any strict plans. And he asked me to produce someone, and he came up to the studio and we were chatting, and he said, you know, I love the Lightning Seeds stuff. Are you ever going to do any more of that, you know? And I kind of went, well, actually, I've got these half songs done. And I kind of played him a few on the acoustic, and he was like, I want to sign this, and I want to, you know. And I was like, you know, yeah. Anyway, so I ended up signing to him. And, you know, at a certain point, he kind of said, look, you know, I think you should play live, really, and maybe just, if you don't want to be a producer and you want to be, you know, doing this properly, let's go, yeah. So I think I was halfway through producing an album for Dodgy, for the band Dodgy.
Yeah.
So I stopped, and I got Hugh Jones to take over for me. And I started playing live. I've forgotten the question.
The question was around what were your, so you said pride and mixed feelings about Three Lions.
So how did I get to this?
So was it about the fact that you had to stop playing live? Was that the mixed feelings about having to play live?
No, I know what I was going to say. So I started playing live, and it all became a certain thing, and I really enjoyed it. And we did Jollification, and it was just in between Jollification and the next album, Dizzy Heights.
Yeah.
And Jollification, we were in a certain moment, and then when we did Three Lions, initially, you know, there was no great expectation placed on Three Lions. You know, now looking back, it feels like, wow, what a momentous decision. But when I was originally asked to do Three Lions, at first I said, no, I don't really fancy doing a football song, you know. And I was kind of, you know, Life of Riley was obviously, it's a bit like Pure, really, Life of Riley. I think it's probably my second favourite tune. And, you know, it's a very personal lyric, you know, and it's got co-opted into a completely different set of things. So then the idea of doing a football song, I don't know, I was just a bit like, oh, I don't know if I want to do that. Is there any good football song?
But I think, in my opinion, is you undermine it a little bit by saying it's just a football song, because I think it's a sound of hope. I think it's a sound of an optimistic future that you got there.
Are we talking about Three Lions?
Yeah, it completely transcends football, I would say.
I was going to say, initially, I just thought, you know, is there any good football songs? Do I want to do a football song? What's the best it could be? And I kind of said no, you know. And then I thought about it, and I thought, well, the best it could be would be, and I am a Liverpool fan, but that's not why I say this, but the best it could be would be You'll Never Walk Alone, which is a fantastically emotional, brilliant song about kind of sadness, togetherness, community. All those feelings are in that song, of walking through a storm together. And for me personally, when I was younger and my father took me to my first football game, and it would have been about 1966, 67 or something, earlier actually, 64, I would be about 6, I'd be about 64, 65 actually. Mm. And the cop would be singing Beatles songs, and my dad and my uncles and all these men would be singing You'll Never Walk Alone. And I loved music even at that time. And so those, and the lights, it was a midweek game, and it was green grass under the floodlights and Leeds, Liverpool, white, red, men singing Beatles songs. It was overwhelming, and music and football to a degree did kind of fuse a little bit, but also just the feeling of everyone's unity and everyone being, you know, together was kind of, you know, it was a very overwhelming thing, I think. And then I was thinking about, you know, what, I thought, yeah, it would be great. And I was watching fantasy football and I thought, these two guys should sing it. And if I, and when we met, we kind of talked about making a record that was, you know, not about the team, it was about the fans.
Nice.
Really, you know what I mean? Well, I don't know if we strictly said that, but definitely, I think You'll Never Walk Alone, it's about the fans, really. You know what I mean? It's about, you know, it's whatever it is about, I don't know. But, so, you know, I kind of wanted to make something that was quite emotional. And to be fair, we kind of had the It's Coming Home idea, but then they wrote that lyric, which, you know, on there's so many lines in that that really are, you know, very evocative, very emotional, very clever lyric that they wrote, you know. And the record then took on this whole thing. And, you know, I really liked it, and we made the record. But then it wasn't very well received. You know, it was when the FA heard it, they really didn't like it, you know. Well, which is understandable because it's criticising the team. I think they were expecting, we're fantastic, we're going to win the cup. And it was kind of, we know the score, we always blow it. So, yeah, they were like, we can't have this, you know. You need to rewrite it. I want you to call it The Beautiful Game.
Really?
Get rid of those two fellas singing it. You know, and I was like, no, you know, I believe in this, you know. So then it was not going to be with the FA, and we thought, well, we'll do it without them. And then it ended up being with the FA. And, you know, obviously the rest is history. So, but what it did do, so it was a fabulous thing as a bubble in its own self. I'm very proud of it. And it's a fabulous thing. But then in terms of what the Lightning Seeds were doing, it suddenly put us from being a kind of indie band, a little bit off-centre, to right in the middle, which kind of, in a way, brings a different expectation. So people who might have liked, you know, more, you know, less centre stage things would be turned off. And I wasn't really wanting to write something that would appeal to, you know, everyone.
Did it change your approach then after that?
Well, it halved the album sales. Yeah, so the album before sold twice as much as the album after. Everyone thinks it'd be the reverse, but actually the truth is that. So, and it was still fine and everything, but it, you know, definitely didn't help. So, and also it's such a powerful thing that it became difficult at gigs. You know, it became difficult because I didn't really particularly want to play it because, you know, it was for a football competition, and it was, that's what it was, and it didn't define me, and I felt like I want to play Pure more than I want to play Three Lions, because it was, it could overwhelm everything else. So it became difficult. Then you know, you don't want to disappoint people also, so it's a tricky line to find, you know. So initially after Euro 96, I remember, you know, the first couple of rows of the theatres would be kids in Three Lions shirts, in England shirts.
Yeah.
And we are not playing Three Lions. And they'd be crying. You know, you think, well, we've got to play it, you know. So then I'd play it. You know, and it just became, that's why I say a mixed blessing.
Yeah.
So it just, it's been a hard, and now it's kind of good because it's just become this kind of thing. And obviously, even then, I wasn't expecting 20 years later to be talking like this about it, and it to have been number one 3 months ago again. And, you know, so, and I'm very thrilled that that is the case, but it's kind of like a never-ending a never-ending lovely thing that has a bit of a mixed kind of effect, you know.
Interesting, when you listen, if you do listen back to this, the way you described your feelings listening to You'll Never Walk Alone is exactly the what a lot of people would feel about Three Lions. So it's like really great that you achieved that. In regards to like was it a song that was hanging about already? Do you have a songwriting session on it? Were there chords that were sticking around for years, or can you remember?
It's a really odd thing actually, because I remember as soon as I decided I'd do it, I thought, I know what I'll do. I've got this thing that I wasn't using, and I just thought that would be perfect for this. And I felt it was like a bit of almost like a Beach Boys-y melody, you know, because it was if you sing in a different way. I think I'd initially put it down on the cassette machine as kind of ba 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 ba, you know, and then it sort of developed from there, and then the intro section stuff. But it kind of surprises me, you know. Like last week, I was having to record the intro played by steel drums and sitar, and it amazes me how adaptable it actually is, you know. And it certainly wasn't in my mind to do anything like that, but in the summer when there was all the memes flying about and brass bands playing it, people on pianos, people on ukuleles, I was like, wow, you know, this is such a sort of ubiquitous kind of track, you know. And whether that's just, you know, whether that's just because it's been around, I don't really know, you know, but it is strange the way it's so adaptable.
It's a song that completely transcends football, and it's, as I say, for me it's the sound of hope, and it's interesting that it's the sound of hope in 1996 and even in this summer, and even every time I hear it in between, it's just the sound of an optimistic future. It's such a nostalgic song, and so yeah, you should be really, really proud of it, which I'm glad you are. To be successful in the music industry, it needs a lot of resilience. What was the biggest setback in your career, and how did you approach overcoming it?
I think you're right. I think, you know, you need a lot of resilience to the point where it's your obsession, really, because, you know, whoever you are, you know, there's going to be moments where it's extremely difficult, you know, and to keep that belief in yourself. And I think the thing is, you're very lucky if you have the right people around you, to be fair. I mean, if, you know, talking about the Coral earlier, it would really help if you were, or the Beatles, maybe more than the Coral. You know, if you're four mates and you're a close unit and you've been at school together, you've kind of grown up together, you've been through the mill together, I think you kind of need that to reinforce each other in a way, and you get a strength from the four of you. It is kind of difficult just being, you know, one person, where you feel like, well, if I, you know, there were times where you felt like, well, if I don't decide I'm going to write a tune for the Lightning Seeds or for Lightning Seeds early on, then if I feel like that day, it doesn't exist. You know what I mean? It's not like there's a residue there and someone else is going to knock at the door and say, come on. You know, it's like,
yeah,
completely doesn't exist, you know what I mean? So I think that, and I think what's really difficult, you know, record companies kind of come and go for artists, and I think you're very lucky if you find a manager. I think a really good manager is someone who loves you, you know, and they're the person who, when things are, you know, when everyone else has written it off, they're the person who, in spite of the logic of it, sticks with you. But that is very rare in managers these days. It's mostly managing companies with people working under them and the bottom line and how much did that earn, and, you know, and it's a very different thing. So it's a two-edged sword, you know. So a lot of the time when people starting out, they have a manager who's a mate, and right, generally, yeah, those mates aren't very good at being managers. But if those two things happen to coincide, and the guy who's your mate turns out to be a really good manager, I think that is the perfect scenario, you know.
Yeah.
And you're in it together, but they are, you know, good at doing it. I think for an artist, I think that's priceless, really. And I think a lot of the big artists, you know, you look at the Beatles, there was Brian Epstein, you look at U2, there was that guy who was with them all the time, I've forgotten his name, you know, I've forgotten his name now, but you know, those kind of bands, you do tend to find the infrastructure is there's a lot of support for them, really. I think Coldplay are kind of an example of that, where they have all these people who've been there since the very beginning, you know, crew. And I think there's Radiohead, you know. Mm-hmm. I think that's a really big thing. It's very difficult when you, you know, you just have a manager who, you know, gives a ring when it's good. A lot of managers do that, you know.
You played a gig a few years ago with an orchestra, and it was kind of all your best tunes, and you had different people up on stage, and it was a very special night. Why was it never released? Because I think it was due to be. Is that right? Did you record it for a release in the end, and will it ever be heard? Because I think those tunes sounded so great with an orchestra.
Thank you. Yeah, no, the idea was that's really pretty much the only Ian Brody gig, so it wasn't a Lightning Seeds gig, mm-hmm. and it was a great band, and, you know, Bill Ryder-Jones played the guitar, Sean was on the drums, the orchestra, some of the songs that I've produced, you know, James Correll got up and sung, Ian McCullough, you know, all those things. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of a bit of a thing of my production, as well as it was like uniting those two things. And it was really great. And I recorded it and I've got it. But I felt like I wanted to finish my album. And I thought that might be 6 months, and it's been a lot longer. So I've still got it, and I still plan to make it available. But I just would like to make it available with new material as well.
Got it. So when I was doing a lot of research for this interview, the last few interviews you've done, you said, "Oh, I'm just about to finish something and put something out," and that kind of went back to 2015, 2016.
Yeah, yeah.
I believe you are recording at the moment. What tell us about that process, and have there been a lot of changes, hence of the delays, or is it the perfectionist in you that wants to make sure it's perfect before you get heard?
No, it's funny. It's I'm struggling to find what sound I, you know, I'm struggling to find. Bad idea, wasn't it? I'm struggling to find what.
Sorry.
I forgot what's not talking. Sorry. Yeah, I've got some tunes, and as always with a one-man band situation like I am, you know, you've got the tunes and you think, well, what's the record going to be? And I want it to be, you know, sound like the Lightning Seeds, but I also don't want it to sound like the Lightning Seeds because that was 20 years ago. So it's a kind of funny conundrum, and I've been through various kind of ways of doing it. So I'm not really using loops so much anymore, because I think that moment has kind of passed, but it doesn't really suit too much live drumming, although I think when the drums go on later it works better. So it's kind of, I've tried various ways, and I've tried to find some records that I think I like at the moment, and I think what's happening is I'm subtracting and subtracting and subtracting. And the concert that you mentioned with the orchestra, I loved singing with the strings and stuff like that. So I'd like to have it very orchestrated,
nice.
But I'd also like to have it hardly anything else on it. So I wanted to have maybe very small sounding drums, not an awful lot, and just melody, vocals and top lines. And I'm finding that's quite a difficult thing to do when you're sitting at home trying to do it, because you haven't got the top lines and the strings and all that. So it's very tempting to build up what you start with, and I've sort of spent my life making the drums sound big and good and everything, and actually I need them to sound pretty unremarkable and small and egoless, and I'm finding that quite hard, really. So I think once I nail the sound of it, everything else just flows, and I feel like I'm really, you know, very close to getting that right now.
We talked about brilliant drummers you've worked with in the past, and one of them currently you're working with is Jim Sharrock, who, nephew of Chris, was taught the drums by Chris. What does he bring to the party? What does he bring as a drummer to the Lightning Seeds? What's his unique qualities?
Well, I think what's great is having Riley and him, who've kind of grown up knowing all the songs, and I've known them both since they were pretty young, you know, and so basically, I think with all bands, like a lot of the time with bands, you get a commonality. So you might be mates at school, or you might be, or even sometimes you form a band and you spend a lot of time together, you're all having a beer, you're in your mate's garage, and you all listen to things together, and you get a commonality and a language that you can use. Because when you're talking about music, everyone has a different you know, a different way of saying things. So you can't really communicate music very well with words sometimes, yeah, unless you know people well, and then you kind of know what they mean. And I think with groups, that's what builds up amongst people. So where it's very lucky is that with Riley and Jim and myself and Martin, the bass player, there is a great commonality. We all know what we're saying to each other, and we're all able to, we come from the same place to a degree. So I think when we're playing live, he's such a great drummer, Jim, you know, he's a really, really great drummer. And he's a great drummer for us.
Right.
You know, and sometimes great drummers aren't great drummers for someone else or for this or that. You know, drummers, you have to, you know, and things suit different things, you know. And I'm sure he'd be a great drummer for everyone. I don't mean that, but I'm just saying for us, it feels like he's a great drummer. And on the recording, I think he and Riley bring a kind of, in the same way I was saying about the choral, sometimes when they are thrilled with something, it sort of gets, it's something for me to see that is quite a good thing, and it makes me, you know, because sometimes I can just be so focused in and demanding of it that I can miss sometimes what I'm doing.
And you mentioned Riley there, how do you compartmentalise being a father and a bandmate?
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? The relationship I had with my dad was very different, I suppose, you know, but you know, Riley's really good. Riley's a really integral part of me. He's such a great guitar player, and he's very good at kind of, you know, some of the practical stuff as well, which I'm not very good at. So him and Jim have both been really quite, you know, played a big part in the new songs and in getting it done and everything. And it's lovely playing with Riley, because I think when it's sort of in the blood, so when we play guitar together, it all fits really well in a way that, you know, you can't really explain, you know.
Mm-hmm. To tell us, when I was at school, I was 11 years old, and there was this girl that I fancied who the hot girls never really spoke to me when I was a kid. And then this girl walked up to me and I was like, fuck, this is the moment she's going to speak to me. And I was like, fuck, like, whatever she says, I've got to make sure I've got the right answer for. And she said to me, I saw that band you liked on Top of the Pops the other night. I was like, oh, right. She went, yeah, the Lightning Seeds. And she went, what's a sugar-coated iceberg? And I didn't fucking know. I didn't know. I had nothing to say to her the first time. So can you please tell us, what is a sugar-coated iceberg? And is it right that you wrote that with Stephen from Baby Bird? Is that right?
Yeah, well... Yeah, Stephen sent me some lines that he thought sounded good, and then I kind of put them together.
What is a sugar-coated iceberg?
Well, it's, you know, I think it depends what you think. But for me, I think we've all met people who look great on the outside but are frozen on the inside.
Ah.
So for me, I think that's the way the lyric is, you know, sometimes, you know, people are great on the outside, but it's not, you know, they're a bit of an iceberg on the inside.
Got it.
So it's an iceberg in maybe it's something that isn't quite what it looks like.
Gotcha. So fly away on sugar-coated wings. I'm sinking deep, I'm going under that sugar-coated iceberg. Tastes so sweet until you. And what's your most important piece of music memorabilia that you own?
Music memorabilia or yeah.
Well, it could be any memorabilia, but...
No, I mean, like, memorabilia. What's memorabilia?
I don't know, just something that, I don't know, an old ticket or an old wristband, something that was signed by someone that you really cared about. What's the, you know, if the house is burning down and everyone was looked after, what's the thing that you've got that means the most to you?
Well, I suppose I quite like, I've got... my uncle went to the premiere of Hard Day's Night in Liverpool, and he had the programme and he had it signed by the Beatles, and he gave that to me, and I've got that, and so that's probably the only memorabilia I've really got. I'm not that big on memorabilia, but I've got that and I really like that.
It's very, very special. Okay, and last question. What fears do you have for the music industry, and how might those fears be addressed?
Sorry?
What fears do you have for the music industry, and how might those fears be addressed?
I don't have any fears for the music industry. The music industry is going to be fine, because I think the record companies always find a way of, that they always make money, and the model is absolutely changing all the time, isn't it? And now there is a completely new model, but they seem to be, you know, making more money out of streaming than they ever were out of anything, I think. You know, it's just the artists who I worry for, you know, because I think the artists are being really harshly treated. And I think it'd be very difficult for a young band now. I think it's very difficult. I think one of the things that is difficult is, I think when I was a kid, you know, you had bands who were coming out and you would compare them, you know, do you like the Sex Pistols, do you like the Clash, do you like Television, Talking Heads? Now with YouTube and with Spotify and, you know, however old you are, you can key in and you can see the Smiths or the Doors or Frank Sinatra absolutely in their prime as young men at the peak of their powers playing a concert, playing live. And you go on Spotify and you've instantly got access to all this stuff, and you've got your Spotify list and it might read like the Beatles, the Doors, the Smiths. But so now I think bands are to a degree competing with not just what's happening now, they're competing with the whole of history, with Led Zeppelin, with, you know, Led Zeppelin are getting as much space on Spotify probably as, I don't know, the 1975. Do you know what I mean? So I think you're kind of competing to a degree with the whole of history and the present time. And I think if you do something, I think in the past, whatever scene it was with youth culture, whether it was ska or before that, the mod scene or punk rock, the legend of it and the idea of it was maybe better than the reality. But now someone at your third gig has got their phone out and is filming it and putting it up on YouTube. So everyone is hearing it right from, you know, too early on. There's no time for it to become something more than an idea. So I think now, you know, bands, you know, it might be an idea that could develop into a scene and could be something really good. But always with these things, they're not as good as they should be yet, but there's an excitement. And sometimes the harsh reality of someone recording it on a phone, putting it onto the internet, or just, you know, not even on the internet, you're seeing a bad version of it. And you make a judgment straight away. And I think it kills a lot of things when they're still in a baby stage, whereas, you know, I'm not sure if everyone had seen footage of the Sex Pistols playing their first couple of gigs, whether anyone would have been that excited about it. But the idea of it and the propaganda of it and the whole thing and the way it turned into something, by the time it was ready to be heard, it was great.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's why you haven't really had a musical movement or youth culture with music, you know, for a long, long time, whereas it used to be every 4 or 5 years, from glam rock to punk rock to new romantics to ska, there's always something. And there really is, it's a long time since there's been anything with that kind of energy. And I don't think there will be again, maybe.
Great answer. Well, thank you for appearing. You've written songs that are going to be played for decades and decades. You've shaped culture through your art, so kudos for that. Look forward to getting the album finished and hearing that and being released. We can't wait to hear it. It's an uncertain time now, so release of Pop Magic will be welcomed by all, I reckon. So good luck tonight, and we hope you enjoyed appearing on the Stage Left podcast.
Thanks very much. It's been lovely talking to you. Thank you.
Exactly what you do, how I fell in love.
Thanks so much to Ian. What a legend. Thanks to Riley too. I particularly love the deep dive into Three Lions and what it means to him today. A song that means a lot to me. And a lot of other people, and the link to You'll Never Walk Alone absolutely blew me away. So thank you so much to Ian for doing that. We hope you enjoyed it. For more episodes featuring the likes of Aziz Ibrahim on his time in the Stone Roses, Gem Archer of Oasis, Damon Minchella, Tony Visconti, Steve Cropper, Stuart Lee, the comedian, on how his creative process is derived from watching freestyle jazz, go to thestagedeathpodcast.com, follow us on Twitter at thestagedeathpod, like us on Facebook at facebook.com/stagedeathpodcast. And if you want to come to one of our live events in London, in a lounge of just 8 people, with the following coming up: so James Walsh of Star Sailor, Romeo of the Magic Numbers, Jane Mailer of Liam Gallagher's band and Kasabian, She Drew the Gun, Goldheart Assembly, John Woff of the 1975, Clive Deamer of Radiohead and Portishead. Have dinner with them and hear them play live in a room that's tiny, only fits 8 people. Drop us an email if you want to get involved with that, which is stageleftnights@gmail.com. Okay, we'll see you next time.